Here is the index for this disc, which covers Tandem Club Journal number 264 for February-March 2016. Track 2 is the preamble, track 3 the editorial, track 4 news and letters, track 5 rally news, track 6 international rally update, track 7 the tale of Normandy part 2, track 8 the route de Grande Alpe part 2, and tracks 9 and 10 cover the long Derbyshire route. I'm afraid we've had little time to cover all of the thing this time because there were a large number of very long articles. Hope you enjoy it, and if there is anything else that you want to say to us, please don't hesitate to get in touch. My telephone number is 01792 796 735. My email address is ifandjill, that's E-I-F, and the word and, J-I-L-L, ifandjill, at AOL.com. Many of you have already been in touch to state your preference for disc or receiving this online. Many of you will remain silent, in which case I assume you still want the disc. Anyway, it's always nice to hear from you, whatever you have to say. So, goodbye for now. Catch you next time. Thank you, goodbye. Hello, and welcome to the Tandem Club Journal number 264 for February-March 2016. I'm going to start with apologies if there are noises off. We are still experiencing the tail end of Storm Imogen around here, and winds have been gusting locally up to 80-odd miles an hour, so sorry about the roaring noise. The editors of the magazine are still Bob and Karen Bending, and they still live at 2 Burnley Close, Tadley, Hants, RG263NQ, November, Quebec. They can be emailed at editor@tandem-club.org.uk. Emails are preferred if possible, but the telephone number is 01189 810264. And if you are sending copy for the next magazine, the deadline is the 22nd of March, please. And the reminder that opinions expressed in this journal are those of the contributors and not necessarily those of the Tandem Club. Likewise, acceptance of advertisements does not imply endorsements. Thank you.
Hello, this is Jill taking over to do the editorial by Bob and Karen. I think this is the first time we've really had to struggle to lay the Tandem Club journal out and include everything we're supposed to. The reason? Lots of rally information. The agenda for the AGM at the Easter Rally in the New Forest, please try to make it if you can, and the tail end of two long but interesting tales we started in the last issue. So, if the text appears a little bit more dense this issue, it's closed up by design to make it all fit. Thank you, Bob and Karen.
News and letters. And the first letter is from JD Tandems. Dear Bob and Karen, just letting you know that JD Tandems in Gargrave are hosting their annual social weekend to coincide with this year's Tour de Yorkshire. The weekend will kick off officially on Saturday, 30th of April. The first ride of the day will leave Gargrave around 8 a.m. and will head to Otley to watch the start of the race, returning back to Gargrave with a cafe stop for lunch en route. Distance around 60 miles. There is a shorter ride planned, but this will leave from Bolton Abbey around 9:30 a.m, so it will mean driving there. The ride will then head to Otley to watch the start of the race, with a cafe stop en route back to Bolton Abbey. Distance around 30 miles. The day will finish with food at JD Tandems, cost for the evening meal around £15 per person. Wine, beer and soft drinks will be provided by us. On the Sunday, the Tour of Yorkshire is not that close by, so we'll have two rides that day, one from the shop in Gargrave, and there will also be an option to drive out to East Yorkshire for a leisurely ride and to watch the tour go by. If anyone is around on the Friday afternoon, then the race in fact is going past the shop, so we'll be heading out onto the street to watch it go by. Apart from this, there are no organised activities for the Friday. Anyone is welcome to join in, but if you're planning on coming along for food on the Saturday evening, then booking is essential as numbers are limited. A detailed itinerary will be available a bit nearer the time. Check the JD Tandems website for updates on www.tandems.co.uk, and please let Ruth or Jamie know if you're planning on joining them. The phone number is 01756 748 400. Or you can email Jamie, that's J-A-M-I-E, jamie@tandems.co.uk. Happy tandeming from Ruth and John at JD Tandems.
And now a letter from Linda Bailey. Hi, Bob and Karen. I have a copy of James Peatling's The Tandem, an illustrated guide, that he sent me, assuming I was still the editor. It is a compilation of old tandem articles from approximately 1892 to 1954. It is 72 pages of A4 size, bound in a card cover, that is retailing at £10, including postage and packing. He was hoping that I would write a review for the magazine, probably in the hopes that older members would be interested to buy a copy. It looks interesting, but neither David nor I are into the old historical stuff. Therefore, anything I write would really be unfair and negative, as not our thing. I think the best plan would be to send it to someone who is interested, so that they can read it and write a brief review. If anyone is interested in reviewing the book, email lindarbailey2@aol.com, and I'll be happy to forward it to anyone willing or interested to read it and write a review for us all. Thank you, Linda Bailey.
Rally news. Details and booking arrangements for all of this year's rallies are in this or previous editions of the journal, and this journal includes a paper copy of the booking form. But please use the online booking system if at all possible, as it makes the administration for all concerned much easier. NotChecks have identified and fixed a problem with their system, but should you have a problem when booking, do not press the back button or try again, as this will generate a second booking. Instead, contact the webgroup email, which is webgroup@tandem-club.org.uk, or phone me on 01793 520 734. This is Tony Pritchard. We are looking at possible venues for the national and international rallies for 2017 and an interesting idea for 2018.
Tandem 2016 National Rally at Kirkley Hall, Ponteland, Newcastle upon Tyne, Tyne and Wear. On Saturday the 6th of August to Saturday the 13th of August 2016. OS Land Ranger Map 88, reference 152773. When agreeing in principle to host this year's National Tandem Rally, I took a huge leap of faith. I agreed after a conversation in the rally field at the Kettering Rally, and after a chat with Audrey and Ken, who are part of the North East group. In reality, I hadn't stepped foot in the county, added to which at the time we lived in the South West. However, after time and thought, the suggestion was broached, and we now have a wonderful team here to support this rally. Many a mile has already been ridden to plot the routes, which range from 9 miles up to 70 or 80 miles. We have the Velocio Trophy and Hill Climb sorted. The team are going to make the winners of the Hill Climb really work for the title this year. What I've been really impressed with while sorting out this rally is the sense of community and teamwork around the National. A third of a mile from the rally site is a local bike shop, a cycling cafe, and the owner has been amazing and is happy to offer help for anyone who has a breakdown. For the more adventurous, he will be running an ODAC-style ride on the Sunday of the rally. When I contacted the local police about the event, they sent me the form we would need for planning the event. Everyone we have approached when saying we are hosting this has been so very helpful, which I have to say is something very typical of the North East. With a big camping field, rooms in the student accommodation, 3 meals available to order each day, and a full host of evening activities, I am so looking forward to this rally. I hope you are too.
For bookings, please note that we are unable to supply electric hookups. We can only accept bookings for the rally dates, which are the 6th to the 13th of August. There is no option to arrive early or stay on. Repeating, please use the online booking system on the club's website if at all possible. There is an application form in this journal, and this mainly covers the rally, accommodation and trips. We will circulate the menu for pre-ordering meals and other options closer to the event. Inquiries, if you have any questions about the rally, please contact Vanessa Bullock. Her telephone number is 01912 855 250, or email lowercase tcn2016@tandem-club.org.uk. See you in August, the North East team. The terms and conditions will follow. As soon as I found the page. The closing date for bookings for the National is Thursday the 30th of June 2016. Your booking is not confirmed until payment has been received in full. Members only. This rally is only open to members of the Tandem Club UK and associated clubs. Annual membership is £10 or €18 per year, with membership for the first joint member or family member free. If you'd like to become a member of the Tandem Club, go to the subscription details page on the Tandem Club website. And the disclaimer, if you participate in any ride or event organised by the Tandem Club, you do so entirely at your own risk. The club, its officers and ride organisers accept no responsibility for loss, damage to property, accident, injury or death that may occur, however caused, whether by negligence, deliberate act or otherwise. Important bit, cancellations and refunds. The rally fee will not be refunded after the closing date. Other components will depend on what the club can recover from the campsite or other suppliers.
Update on the International Tandem Rally 2016. This is May the 28th to June the 4th, 2016, in Charm, the Netherlands. Campsite website, tinyurl.com/05tandem. The booking form for this international rally can be found in the December-January issue, but please use the online booking form if possible. Important: early arrival. Campers and tenters and caravans, if you arrive one or a few days before the start of the rally, you officially have to book the extra night through the De Flasbloem. However, you do not make a reservation in advance, but arrange it at the reception upon arrival. This will save you the administration costs of €16.50. Tell them you are joining the rally and they will direct you to our field. Chalets can only be booked from Friday until Friday and from Friday until Monday. So if you want to stay from Saturday until Saturday from the rally, you have to book 1 week and a weekend. Check for discounts, as you can find on the website. In the addition to the bookings, your chalet will still have to use the booking form to subscribe to the rally.
A another tale of Normandy, July 2015, part 2. And incidentally, part 1 was on track 12 of the previous journal, 263. July the 9th, 2015. Time to start heading back. And of course, the weather had improved greatly, now that it was almost time to leave. This, among other things, meant that we had definitely decided to camp for our last night. After all, we had carried the tents, mats, sleeping bags, pocket rocket, gas canister and porridge all over Normandy. We really did have to get around to using them at some point. So we paid up and made a quick visit to the very small market, which had set itself up among the fun fair on the square. This had been slowly assembling itself since we arrived in preparation for the fete on the 11th. Then we found our way back to the bottom of the steep hill we had plummeted down on our first evening in the town, set off uphill, and somehow missed an important turning as we climbed. We convinced ourselves that we were going the right way, or at least a right way, well, a way anyway. But our conversation ran into sand at the same time as the road when, at the top of the long steep climb, it turned itself into an unpaved track. With surprisingly little recrimination, we turned the tandem round and sped back down the hill. Gone, I bet it was worth it. We found the right climb fairly easily after that, and retraced more or less our route of the previous day. It all looked very different in the sunshine, of course. In particular, Bazoches, or Holm, turned out to be extremely pretty, with an enormous old church backing into what looked like an enclosed park. We stopped for a coffee at the cafe we'd been to the previous day, and since we were greeted with a smile, I assume all was forgiven. We were running across the grain of the land, so once again there was much swooping and whooping, followed by grinding climbs. But today this was mostly in glorious sunshine, and actually very moderate temperatures. Perfect cycling weather, in fact. At one point, our IGN map showed a road with dotted edges. On an OS map, this is a road with no fence or hedge. But on an IGN map, this is a track. Still, there was an alternative which did have tarmac, so we used that.
On the road to or through Martinvale, and there's a map with some interesting looking road signs on it, that we hit our trip maximum speed on a glorious sweeping descent with a clear line of sight. I think we could have gone faster, but the stoker's shrieks persuaded me to brake. At Angleville, we finally turned to go along a ridge rather than across it, and this brought us to our final downhill of the day, to Thury Harcourt, which is where we had left the Voie Verte a couple of days early, and also where we were going to camp for the night. It was only just after 1 p.m. We almost decided to push on and spend the night in a hotel in Rivabella, but the internet signal wouldn't allow us to book online, and our chosen hotel wouldn't match the web price over the phone, so we stuck with Plan A. The campsite in Thury Harcourt is by the river, only in this case it's the River Trapsey, a tributary of the Orne. The site is fairly small, and to my delight had turtle doves singing in the trees and spotted flycatchers flitting about in shady spots. These two were once common birds of the English summer, but agricultural intensification has all but wiped them out from most of the country, along with many others. We dithered and argued about where to pitch our tent, and eventually chose a place where Juliet judged there wouldn't be too much early morning sun. And she was right, as it happens. We explored the facilities, unisex sanitation block with no toilet paper, so we harvested some from the adjacent leisure centre where Juliet went for reduced rate swim. Into Thury Harcourt for our final evening meal of the trip, once again the strong pound coming to our rescue and making us feel relatively well off. Then to sleep, quite a restful night under canvas, well, under siliconised nylon to be accurate. Total cycling for the day, 32 miles, maximum speed, 35.66 mph.
July the 10th, 2015. Since this was to be the last day of the trip, the sun really did come out in a big way. It was already warm by 7 a.m, and the forecast was for temperatures in the high 20s. Juliet had a lie-in while I watched the sun creep up over the firs behind the campsite. I was entertained by a robin, which had no apparent fear of me, but seemed to regard me as some sort of inconvenience. Perhaps I was in his way. Porridge and coffee over, finally using the pocket rocket, we set off back up the slight hill into Thury Harcourt. The pâtisserie at the junction provided us with the most luscious pain au chocolat and croissant of the trip. I was sure that the Voie Verte started just down the hill after the junction with the main road. Sure, but wrong. It didn't take us long to find it, though, and we were off into a flawless, still morning. The track is very shady, so we were kept out of the worst of the sun until we got to Caen. With a very light breeze and no headwind, we were able to coast along comfortably at between 19 and 20 miles an hour, scattering solo cyclists and inline skaters in our tracks. We may have actually done this in a literal sense, but I think he had fallen before we got to him, honest. It is difficult to tell, as he refused all offers of help and wasn't very talkative. Still, no damage to his bike and only minor flesh wounds. Sounds fascinating. The Orne Gorge looked even better in the bright summer sun, and for much of the way, all we could hear was the sound of the wind in the leaves. It certainly is cycling heaven. As we neared Caen, cycling traffic picked up a bit, which is what you would expect.
We crossed the Orne on an old iron latticework rail bridge, the climb up to which was the second hill of the day. The route then hit low traffic roads until at the edge of Caen it merged with the local bike network. This is mostly either traffic-free, shared pavement, or physically segregated, so cars aren't a problem. I still managed to nearly hit one at a crossing, though, when I totally misread the situation. I braked in time, but Juliet was not pleased with my performance. Stopping only for a hamburger and some sparkling water, we pushed on through Caen and Oystraham and Riva Bella. It was getting quite hot now, and the only way to keep cool was to keep moving. I don't know why it is, but even though I'm a peaceful kind of soul, whenever I'm at the French coast, I just want to slap people. Something about the designer haircuts and must-have handbags just gets my goat. And this wasn't even the Riviera, it was Normandy. Oh well, I guess it's what people enjoy, and it may be why other cycle tourists always look neater than us. Actually, we quite liked the strangely gothic houses and quiet streets of Riva Bella. We even attempted a brief westerly excursion down the coast, but it all turned a bit sandy, so we went back to the embankment by the ferry port and found some shade. An English cyclist who had just arrived off the ferry spent some time chatting to us about the tandem. He was cycling to Monte Carlo via Mont Ventoux. We were getting a boat back to Portsmouth. Oh well, there's always another day. The final leg was from Ferryport back to Nick's house in Fareham. This was in the dark, but the jury-rigged lights proved reasonably visible, and Google kept us out of the traffic. The next day, Nick and his wife were holding their 25th anniversary party, so there would be no cycling, but probably a lot of eating and drinking. Something to look forward to. Total cycling for the day was 43 miles. Total for the trip was 181.
And now some technical stuff about the journey. Bluebell Skyrocket is an orbit velocity comp with tubus racks. She was bought new in May this year and is our second tandem. We tour with Ortlieb gear, our classic roll-top rear panniers are 20 years old. The tent is a Big Agnes Copper Canyon, which is a very good compromise between weight and space. Less than 2 kilos, but big enough for two with two vestibules. The ferry was the Brittany Ferry Summer Service Portsmouth Caen. Juliet is the stoker, even though she is stronger because she weighs less than me, and it seems to work better that way. We are both the same height, and the photos are by me and by Juliet.
This is part two of the Route des Grandes Alpes by Tandem, and it follows on from the previous CD, which on track 14 you heard part one. And this is from Helen and Chris Dace. And we're now up to day 7, Oiseaux de Brancon, distance 97 kilometres, with 2,150 metres of climbing and 2,276 metres of descent. And we took 7 hours, 24 minutes. It takes about 6 minutes to soft boil an egg in Oiseaux. The water boils at a lower temperature at altitude, so leave a little extra time for breakfast. Our proprietor is a skier and cycles in summer to keep fit, so he had a track pump in his garage. I got very excited about being able to get the tyres to 100 psi for the first time on our tour. For a change, we had some downhill to start the day, in fact 20 kilometres of freewheeling. Saint-Jean-de-Marienne is the town at the foot of the Col de Telegraph. We stopped there briefly to take off a layer of clothing before starting the climb. The first few kilometres meander through a residential area before rising through woodland, revealing impressive views of the valley we had just cycled through. It's a fairly constant 7% for the whole 12 kilometres. At the col, we donned an extra layer and enjoyed a smooth ride down to Valois, where we found a patisserie for lunch. I had a slice of pizza, which I soon regretted, as we got stuck into the next climb. The Col de Galibier, at an 18-kilometre climb from Valois. There's some respite after a bit of climbing to get out of Valois. The road levels off for a while, or maybe it becomes 4% instead of 8%. We soon reached the lunar landscape mentioned in the guidebook. What we didn't expect to see were the marmots sunning themselves on the road ahead. We decided on a strategy of frequent stops to drink and snack. It started to get a lot colder nearer the top, and we had to get our jackets on while we were still climbing. About 1 kilometre from the top, cars have an option to take a tunnel through the mountain rather than going over the pass. That final ascent is really hard, especially in the rain. The gradient increases and, well, we were tired by then. Another kind soul took a few snaps of us at the top to prove we'd done it. Then we got our leg warmers on and started to descend as soon as we could. The temperature by this time was 2 degrees centigrade. Unlike our descent from Col de Lisenran, the rain persisted on the south side of the pass and it didn't get any warmer. We dropped a few hundred metres and found a restaurant which offered us a chance to get warm. We bought some hot soup and the waitress brought us dressing gowns to keep warm. They were obviously prepared for nutcases like us. By now, wearing most of the clothing we'd brought with us and with our buffs under our helmets, we started our descent again and eventually left the rain behind. Luckily, the road became a tandem-friendly, long, straight, 1% run, so we were able to cane it all the way to Briancon and look forward to our rest day. Our room has a kitchenette, dishwater, washer, heated towel rail, bath and a fridge, so it's perfect for our day off. We washed and dried our clothes and put our bidons through the dishwasher. We ate in the hotel bistro, chicken cooked in beer, potatoes and a really fresh salad with proper French dressing. I think we earned it today.
Day 8, Briancon, rest day. We've looked back on some trips and regretted not spending more than a single evening in one place. So we planned a rest day in Briancourt, the highest city in France, at 1,326 metres. Our hotel, Le Temple, is in the old part of town opposite L'Église, a good place from where to explore the historic centre. Unlike yesterday, the weather was gloriously sunny, so it is nice just to wander the steep avenues of the fortified town and take in the atmosphere of the place. Most of the buildings are 4 or 5 stories high and painted in subtle shades. We walk down to the modern part of the town, to the Leclerc, to buy provisions for our stay, as we found ourselves in a self-catering apartment. Who can resist a French supermarket? There was a small market in the centre of town, Wednesday, where we bought homemade lasagna for supper. The hotel restaurant hosted a folk group that travels through France by tractor. We clearly picked the place to stay in Briancourt. Our legs deserved a rest today.
Day 9 is Briancourt to Rissol, distance 55 kilometres, ascending 1,359 metres and 1,550 metres of descent, which took them 4 hours 20 minutes. We should be in Glestre this evening, but the nearest accommodation we could book is just up the road in a village called Rissol. We had a quick look around Glestre, enjoyed a couple of precision, then continued to Rissol to eat at a local auberge next to our gîte, La Maison de Josephine. We have an amazing view from our ground floor window, and there are some lovely pictures of winding roads down through the mountainsides. We have an amazing view from our ground floor window, looking northwest over a river valley towards the historic village of Mont Dauphin and Le Pelvaux, at about 4,000 metres high, imposing in the distance. Today was a relatively short ride down from Briancourt, up and over Col d'Il Zodard, and then a little long gentle valley road to Glestre. It was a beautiful day and the scenery was stunning. The ascent to Col d'Il Zodard is long but not too steep and meanders through pines and melèzes. The heat and the scent from the pines reminded us of Bordeaux. The road surface is excellent for most of the ascent, and there is a marked cycle lane on the right-hand side of the road. It doesn't get much better than that. We got the twisty bits of the descent done and then stopped at a patisserie in Arvieux. We bought some pain, the first pain au raisin of the tour, and some tea. It was so hot on the terrace, such a contrast from our previous descent.
I think this article ought to come with apologies to French speakers. And on that note, day 10, Rissol to Josier. I may have got it right, I may not. The distance, 46 kilometres, ascent, 1,187 metres, descent, 1,033 metres, and we took 4 hours and 3 minutes. We enjoyed another really good night's sleep. It must be the mountain air or something, such as sighting up mountains day after day. Our bio breakfast included porridge oats, raisins, homemade jams, toast and coffee served in proper-sized mugs. We faffed about a bit while packing up, subconsciously delaying our departure, and another 20 kilometres of uphill cycling. We were blessed with good weather again, clear blue skies, and a pleasant 16 degrees centigrade at 9:30 a.m., which rose to about 30 degrees centigrade by lunchtime. Hot, but after nearly freezing to death on Col du Galibier, I got there, we're not complaining. The Col de Vars is another long, steady climb, which offers some respite at about 9 kilometres on reaching the 3 villages that are part of Vars. On a hot day like today, the best thing about reaching the flat section near Vars was that we could get up sufficient speed to shake off the swarm of flies that were buzzing around us. When cycling at 6 to 10 kilometres per hour and sweating like mad, you become a fly magnet, we stopped to liberally apply some of Helen's citron-scented perfume. It didn't do much to deter the flies, but we smelt better. There's a long valley descent down to our final stop for the night. We arrived by lunchtime, and being hungry, we stopped at the first restaurant in Josière and ordered Sagna burger and chips. The Chalet de... Here we go again. Wanoa is basic, but has a small pool on the terrace. Great views over the valley. A room to store your bike. We checked in, took a dip in the pool, chatted with some Dutch guys who've been cycling around here for the past 6 days, read on the sun terrace for a while, then walked back to the village to eat in the same restaurant where we had had lunch. It seems that Josière is a one-restaurant town. Tomorrow is a big cycling day, La Col de la Bonnette, and an 87-kilometre ride to Roubion. I believe that includes nearly 20 of your English miles of cycling against the force of gravity.
Day 11 is Josière to Roubion, distance of 97 kilometres, ascending 2,500 metres, descending 2,300, taking them nearly 8 hours, all but 1 minute.
7 hours, 59 minutes.
We wanted an early start, so requested breakfast at 7:30 a.m. It was just us and the proprietor and his huge black cat, Kinder, who looks more like a black panther. We chatted amiably about his guests, electric bikes and the local skiing. Before we left, we pumped the tyres to 100 psi again. These Continental four-season Vectron tyres have been brilliant touring tyres. 28mm tyres gives a comfortable ride, and we haven't had a single puncture on the entire trip. We stopped at the water fountain in Josière's to fill our bidon, then turned right to start the climb and settled into a comfortable cadence. Within a few kilometres, a big group of cyclists went past us. It was clear from their terrible bonjours that they were English. They were cycling from Aix-la-Bande to Nice in 3 days. That's impressive, even though they had support vehicles and no luggage to haul. The climb itself is long, but doesn't get really steep until the very end. The scenery is spectacular, with a mix of forest on the lower sections, river valleys and open mountainsides. This is probably the most beautiful climb on the entire route. The first couple of hours was really peaceful, but very little traffic on the road. We made the top in good time, had the regulation photographs in front of the col marker. Helen walked up the final climb for the view. Legend has it that you can see the Med on a clear day. The descent was hard work, mainly because it was so windy. We had to stop to adjust our spire disc brakes, which get a bit sloppy on a long descent. Towards the end of the descent, we came across an old chap in the middle of the road who gestured for us to slow down and said something to us, French, as we slowly passed. Suddenly, a huge flock of sheep came towards us. We stopped, and they dutifully found their way round us, separating like water going round a rock before coming together again. As we approached Saint-Sauveur-sur-Tinée, I noticed that the Garmin flashed up a right turn on our route, the start of the climb to Roubion, towards our chambre d'hôte for the night. Why had we booked a hotel that was 8 kilometres off our route, up an 8% climb? This was a schoolboy error in our planning. We could see a small village settled in the hillside. I couldn't quite believe that we would be able to make it all the way, but indeed we did. Another 1,000 metres of climbing, having already done La Bonnette, and we did it before my Garmin battery died to achieve a new record of 2,500 metres of ascent in a day. We decided to walk the last bit, having learnt
that most we were most likely to fall off when we're both feeling tired and cycling slowly at the end of a long journey. We were delighted to learn that the lady who runs one of the two restaurants would keep it open for us, so we were able to satisfy our cravings for pizza, rosé wine and a chocolate crepe. We decided to continue up to the Col de l'Aquilole tomorrow, which is on my cycling jersey, so must be part of the official route, and then take a slightly different route to Nice.
Day 12. Roubion to Nice. I can pronounce Nice. Distance 126 kilometres, including 1,237 metres of climbing and 2,553 metres of descent. We took 8 hours and 3 minutes. So, our last day of cycling, and we decided to depart from our carefully pre-planned route. This is an adventure, after all. The truth of it is that the climb to Roubion to get to our chambre d'hôte was such an effort that to turn back and retrace our steps was too demoralising. We were actually still on the official route de Grande Alpe, and if we climb for another 5 kilometres, we will have added another col to our list. Col de la Culilol, or whatever Jill said earlier. After extensive consultation with a lady who runs one of the two restaurants in Roubion, and then over breakfast with the proprietor of La Rupricapra, we decide to follow the route along the M30, which takes us over the Col to Bull, and then the M28 south, through the Gorge Supérieure du Quien, which we have on good authority as Très Jolie. My preference was then to go back towards La Tour and pick up our carefully planned route. However, the stoker and the proprietor convinced me that it's better to take the M6202. I'm a bit concerned that instead of having an elevation profile, we have a rough translation that once we reach Puget-Thénier, the road is a bit up and down. The descent is much better than I'd imagined. I'd surreptitiously googled the gorge route and is listed on Most Dangerous Roads in Europe website, which didn't fill me with confidence. Although it's a balcony road, we were hugging the mountainside for most of the descent, which meant that there were only a few times that I had to stop myself from looking to the side. I really don't like heights at all. And there's a photograph here showing the road hugging the mountain on one side and a sheer drop the other side. The gorge is very attractive, with lots of red-brown rock in places. At the end of the gorge descent, we crossed the river Lavant and took the M221 towards La Penne. This was where we discovered that a bit up and down actually meant a half-hour climb. To be fair, after this ascent, the rest of the ride was mostly flat or downhill. We followed the M17 to Cigale and Roquestron, eventually reaching La Villa and Gillette. We stopped for an ice cream and a coffee in a very small village. The landscape changes dramatically in this part of the trip, with melèze and pine gradually replaced with olive and cypress trees. Although the road continued to descend, sometimes by 1-2% only, the cycling became tougher as the northwesterly wind picked up. This regular afternoon breeze we'd experienced since reaching the Southern Alps was probably the Mistral. Once we reached Gillette, for the first time we could see the wide course of Lavard just before it continued down to the east of Nice. We freewheeled down to La Ruquia and saw a signed cycle path that would take us the final 16 kilometres to Saint-Laurent-du-Vin, hugging the western bank of the river. We crossed Lavant, even the bridge has a cycle path, and then skirted Nice Airport before picking up the Promenade des Anglais, following our forefathers' footsteps. We arrived at our destination for the final 2 days of our tour, La Villa Victor Hugo, which is a small 3-star hotel. The receptionist let us bring the tandem into the hotel, and by dropping the wheels out, we were able to squeeze it into the luggage room while we went to our room and freshened up. As it was Sunday, we were advised that the only restaurants open would be in the old town, a 10-minute walk away. We were so tired, we plumped for the first brasserie that we came across, which was fine. Rather than any any great feelings of elation on that evening. Above all, we were relieved that we'd made it to Nice safely without crashing or suffering any major mechanical failure, or even a single puncture.
Day 13. A nice day in Nice. Very funny. I get the feeling that Nice has changed a bit since the Stranglers sang the line "So nice in Nice, so nice and neat." Neat isn't the word I'd choose to describe it. It's definitely a city of contrasts and a great place for people watching. We enjoyed our day there a lot. We spent some time on the beach, wandering around the Matisse Museum and through the old town, eating soccer, visiting the flower market, watching the super yachts come in and out of the marina, and sitting under a shady tree in the park. It was hot. Day 14, Nice to Gatwick. After finally packing up the bike, we checked out of our hotel at lunchtime and took a cab to the airport. As we approached the airport, the driver explained that he wouldn't be able to take us all the way, as there was some kind of strike or blockade. In fact, it was licensed taxi drivers striking over the Uber taxis. A strike in France, who'd have thought it? We had to get out of the cab about 750 metres short of the terminal, which doesn't sound far, but when you're carrying a tandem and luggage in two 20-kilogram non-wheeled bags, it's a long way. Fortunately, we found a trolley and a euro, and 15 minutes later we were dropping off our bags at the EasyJet counter and homeward bound a couple of hours later. It was an epic trip and a tougher physical challenge than we'd anticipated. Stunning scenery, a lot of up and down and extremes of weather. Maybe we'll tour the Netherlands next year. Thank you, Helen and Chris Dace.
Derbyshire, June 2015. On Saturday 20th of June, we set off from Dorset for the small village of Taddington near Buxton in Derbyshire. The tandem travelled safely and uncomplainingly for 5 hours on the roof of our car, thanks to the Helton tandem carrier, whose efficiency deserves high praise. Just outside Taddington, we were amazed to see a cyclist we recognised from Dorset. Bob lives only 5 miles from us, in Spetsbury. How unlikely was that, we marvelled. Alan had managed to find an old Derbyshire OS map amongst the 50 or so we've acquired over the years. This one was in pretty good condition, considering we bought it for 58 pence before our last visit to the Peak District 30 years previously, in 1985. Unfortunately, being so old, it did not show the Monsell Trail, which was on the agenda for the following day.
Sunday, the 21st of June. Butchers on bikes and cyclists wearing dresses. We set off at about 9:30 and whizzed 3 miles downhill towards Millersdale. It was chilly and looked like rain. To our surprise, there were several big groups of cyclists going in the opposite direction, trudging uphill. Amongst their number, we again spotted Bob from Spetisbury on his Mercian. We hurtled past, exchanging waves and shouting greetings. At Millersdale, we met up with the Monsell Trail and headed towards Bakewell, an 8.5 mile traffic-free route running along the former Midland Railway line. This track is deservedly extremely popular with walkers and cyclists. Alan and I were beginning to feel as if every other cyclist in Derbyshire knew something we didn't, which proved to be very much the case. For the following couple of miles, we were greeted by groups of strangely dressed cyclists, all pedalling in the opposite direction. When a chap dressed as a home guard told us we were going the wrong way, we decided he was probably right, and we turned round and went with the flow, albeit in complete ignorance of our destination. It turned out that we had gate-crashed day 3 of the Eroica Britannia event based at Bakewell. To qualify, bikes had to be pre-1987 and riders were encouraged to be suitably attired in vintage clothing. 3,000 cyclists had a choice of three routes,
100 miles, 55 miles and 30 miles. We found ourselves on the shortest ride, which was probably just as well, as a keen glance from any official would have betrayed us as interlopers. But nobody seemed to mind, and it was great fun, chatting to an assortment of cheerful cyclists, many on tandems. We admired several short wheelbase Claude Butler tandems and a Curly Hetchins. For a mile or so, we cycled alongside a couple of on a Jack Taylor, who really looked the part in matching Fair Isle knitted tank tops. Two chaps on a short wheelbase Claude Butler were sporting flying helmets and pedalling along to the accompaniment of wartime music hall songs. There were air raid wardens, home guards and a Victorian policeman dressed in a black cloak and sporting a truncheon. Glamorous young women glided along, looking stately on sit-up and big bikes, wearing high heels, full skirts, stockings with seams and lots of red lipstick. I've never before seen so many cyclists not wearing helmets. In that respect, at least, we fitted in. They all stopped for lunch at Tideswell, but we continued on to Breton, where we ate our picnic outside the Barrel Inn. This is the highest pub in Derbyshire, with terrific views. The sun came out and it began to feel a little warmer. Still on the Eroica route, we continued to Grindleford and on to Iam, the famous plaque village of which more later. People lined the pavements, admiring, cheering and shouting encouragement. Alan and I ducked our heads in embarrassment and hoped no vociferous, sharp-eyed observer would draw attention to our shameful SPD pedals and lycra. Then it was on to Fulo, followed by a long, steep climb to Monsel Head. We walked most of that hill, and so did many Eroica cyclists, but not all. Those who pedalled all the way up earned well-deserved applause. We lingered a while, admiring the views down Monsel Dale and up the Wye Valley. The route continued through Little Longstone, Great Longstone, and the picturesque town of Ashford in the Water, before arriving back at Bakewell. At the showground, we enjoyed looking around the dozens of stalls selling vintage cycle clothing and accessories, plus plenty of modern stuff which had managed to sneak in. I bought a second-hand long-sleeved woolen jersey and averted my eyes wistfully from some women's cycling shorts, cunningly disguised as pretty little skirts. At the age of 64, maybe I couldn't really get away with it. The legs are still okay, but I always remember the grim warning, "It's not the legs, it's the face." We cycled back along the Monsel Trail to Millersdale. Then it was 3 miles uphill back to Taddington at just after 6 p.m.
Monday, 22nd of June. A present from Croatia and a thankful village. We set off at about 9:30, bracing ourselves against a cold, strong wind and trying to ignore slate-grey skies. We toiled uphill to the small village of Flag, then into Moneyash, joining the High Peak Trail at Herdlow, a level 17-mile traffic-free track. This follows the route of the former Cromford and High Peak Railway, one of the world's first long-distance railway lines built between 1825 and 1830. This is part of the Pennine Bridleway and gives great views of the Dove Valley. We pedalled along a fairly narrow path between verges profuse with colourful wildflowers. It was drizzling, and we sheltered briefly in a dry stone roundhouse at Parsley Hay, there's a photograph of it, known as an Istrian Kazun. The information board told us that the shelter was a gift from Croatia to the UK to mark the accession of Croatia to the EU on the 1st of July 2013, constructed by Istrian craftsmen using Peak District limestone. It celebrates a shared tradition of dry stone walling. The opening ceremony was marked by English and Croatian folk dancing and folk music. Much further along the trail, we stop for a damp and chilly lunch close to Brassington and gaze at the nearby wind turbines, which were certainly strutting their stuff in the strong wind. Chatted to a couple of cyclists, one of whom had our 58 pence map, but he'd only paid £8.08 and 6 for his. The trail continues to Middleton Top and Cromford, but as the weather had taken a turn for the worse, we decided to leave it at this point and set off back. We cycled through Brassington and then Bradbourne, whose place sign I was intrigued to see proclaimed it to be a thankful village. A friendly lady, being taken for a walk by her exuberant border terrier, explained that there are 51 thankful or blessed communities in the UK, but Bradbourne is the only one in Derbyshire, so called because they lost no men in the Great War. All right. Bradbourne had about 100 residents at the time of World War I, and 18 men came home safely from the front. At Tissington, we encountered a wide ford, and Alan would have liked to give it a go, but I was already quite wet and cold enough, so we tamely wheeled the tandem over the footbridge. We soon found our way onto the trail, where it was easy cycling, and the rain even eased off long enough for us to sit on a rather damp seat and finish the coolish dregs of tea from our flask and eat the last of the biscuits. Our bench was dedicated to the memory of Ray Reading, 1949 to 2003. Ray urged us to rest your weary legs a while and think of me with a smile. The rain started pelting down with increased vigour, which made smiling a bit of an effort. Back to Herlow, where we bade farewell to the wet and windswept trail, and pedalled on to Moneyash, after which it was a soggy and mainly uphill trudge back to Taddington. The day had been rather an anticlimax after the buzz of Eroica, and with no sighting of Bob's Mercian, it looked as if even he had beetled off back to Spetisbury.
Now Tuesday, the 23rd of June. Lieu of the year and making friends at Tissington Ford. No rain today and even occasional sunshine. Set off at 9:30 and cycled to Miller's Dale, where we joined the Monsell Trail. We listened to some voice recordings giving personal memories from people who lived by, worked on, or travelled on the former Midland Railway. Cycling through the tunnels was quite exciting, if a bit chilly. Alan put the dynamo front light on for the longer tunnels, which were quite dark despite being lit from dawn to dusk. We chatted to a couple of cyclists who'd moved from Hampshire to live in Dumfries and Galloway. They had recently bought a Swallow tandem on eBay and had driven from Scotland to Cambridge to collect it. We dropped down in Bakewell and bought a couple of rather disappointing Bakewell tarts, which we ate beside the river with a cup of tea. A rainbow trout competed with the ducks for bits of discarded pastry, which says a lot about the quality of the tarts. We called into the Tourist Information Centre, hoping to find some leaflets for cycling in the area, since our 58p map was proving rather inadequate. But although mountain biking was well catered for, there wasn't much for road cycling. I visited the ladies, which was a suitably enjoyable experience and one worth sharing. Bakewell has won Lieu of the Year for the past 3 years, a well-deserved accolade, with spotlessly clean cubicles and flowers positioned beside the wash basins. There was even an attendant in a little office next door. It was a long climb out of Bakewell before taking to the Yule Grave Road, or Yule Grieve. Even in Derbyshire they can't seem to agree on how to spell it. And dropping down at 1 in 10 along a quiet lane. I had not come across one of these before, and I discovered later that they are minor rural roads which have been designated by local highways authorities to special attention to the needs of walkers, cyclists and horse riders. Lower speed limits and discreet road signs are intended to encourage motorists to slow down and generally make country lanes safer for everyone who uses them. This one was certainly rather beautiful, and practically traffic-free. In Yulegrave, we exchange a few words with a couple of cyclists who were enjoying pints of Guinness in the sunshine outside the Bull's Head. They hailed from Newcastle-under-Lyme and were doing a recce for a 100-mile sportive. We puffed our way up a seriously steep hill out of Yulegrave before arriving in the village of Elton, and after getting rather lost, we found our way back onto yesterday's High Peak Trail. We passed the time of day with a cyclist who had forgotten to bring the customary lunch of rice and noodles. He had a Primus stove in his saddlebag and was intent on finding a village shop somewhere which would provide the ingredients for his favourite midday meal. We left the trail shortly before Middleton Top and headed towards Carsington Water, a reservoir popular for cyclists. The 8-mile circular ride around the water's edge is part of the National Cycle Network, and we were looking forward to it. But first, we were in dire need of sustenance. There were several seats with views across the water, and we chose one inscribed Tony Leach, 1960 to 2008. Where's the fire? Do you think Tony Leach was a fireman? I suggested, biting hugely and hungrily into a cheese and salad roll. A policeman, I reckon, Alan said. Isn't that what they say when they catch up with a speeding driver? Anyway, he was only 48. It makes you think.
We sat for a while in the lazy sunshine, pondering on life and how shockingly short it could be, which seemed all the more reason for making the most of this beautiful afternoon. The ride around Carsington Water was easy cycling, very enjoyable, and over far too soon. At the visitor centre, it took me ages to find the ice cream kiosk amongst a plethora of shops, cafes and an award-winning restaurant. What with windsurfing, kayaking, canoeing and a choice of circular walks, you could easily spend the whole day here, or even a long weekend if you'd brought your sleeping bag. After a successful ice cream foray, I rejoined Alan, who was chatting to a couple who were very interested in our tandem and thinking about buying one of their own. Only thinking, though. When I leave Alan in charge of the bike for more than a couple of minutes, I invariably return to find someone talking to him about tandems or some aspect of cycling. I don't know if this is also the case with solo cyclists, but maybe not. There seems to be something especially appealing and gregarious about a tandem. Quite right. It was rather late in the afternoon, and we needed to rejoin the trail as soon as possible. We pedalled through Bradbourne again and back to the Tissington Ford, just in time to see two cyclists approaching it from the opposite direction. The young woman, very sensibly in my opinion, got off her bike and walked over the footbridge, but her chap cycled through the ford with great panache and looking rather pleased with himself. We all got chatting, and Graham encouraged us to have a go. Easy peasy, he promised. Janie was full of encouragement too, while remaining firmly and safely on the footbridge. The sun was shining. I was comfortably full of strawberry ice cream topped with clotted cream, and furthermore, I sensed Alan was feeling envious of this intrepid young fellow, young being the optimum word. Tissington Ford is wide and possibly about 6 inches at its deepest point. We swooped into the water, and I shrieked when the tandem suddenly wobbled alarmingly as Alan swerved to avoid a pothole. But we got through unscathed. Graham took photographs of our achievement, and it was our turn to feel modestly pleased with ourselves. Back on the trail, I was beginning to feel tired, but adrenaline is a great motivator, and we fairly raced along for several miles, stopping only for another quick cuppa on Ray Redding's bench. I was amused to see the previous day's biscuit crumbs were still at the end of the seat where I'd put them for sparrows to find. Today we were in high spirits and better able to appreciate the wonderful views over the National Park and across the Sheen Hill. We left the trail at Herdlow and then into Money Ash, followed by the now familiar uphill slog back to Taddington. We heard a curlew and cycled very close to where it was sitting on a dry stone wall. Back at 7 p.m., hungry and weary after a really good day cycling.
And now Wednesday, the 24th of June, 2015. Blue Johnstone and Wolf Hunting. Woke to cloudy skies, but a promising forecast. Off again early and took the Hollow of the Moor road out of Taddington. Heard another curlew, but this one was staying hidden. Cycled through Wormhill, a village renowned in the 14th century for wolf hunting, when the Lord of the Manor accepted wolf heads in lieu of rent. On into the village of Peak Forest. Until the 18th century, the vicar here was allowed to conduct marriages without bothering to read the banns, resulting in the village becoming known as Derbyshire's Gretna Green. We took a quiet rural road out of Peak Forest, which eventually brought us out onto a B road leading to the turning for Winnet's Pass. A long collapsed limestone cave system, Winnet's is a steep-sided limestone valley with cliffs on all sides. We approached the pass at its highest point and watched a cyclist toiling his way up the rather narrow road amongst a steady trickle of cars and coaches. It's mainly a long 10% incline, rising to 20% near the top. We've sat on a flat rock outside the Speedwell Cavern, one of the four show caves, where visitors make the journey into the cave by boat. Over a cup of tea and lavender shortbread biscuits, we looked down towards the busy village of Castleton. Alan took a trip down memory lane, harkening back to his childhood in Barnsley, when Castleton was a favourite family Sunday afternoon jaunt. He remembered sliding down the steep grassy hillside close to the bottom of the pass with his sister when they were about 4 years old. The sun was making an appearance now, and so were the tourists, many heading to a shop selling products made from Blue John stone, a semi-precious mineral which in the UK is found only at Castleton. 30 years previously, on our last visit to Derbyshire, I had bought some Blue John stone earrings at this very shop. We dropped down into Castleton, but didn't linger because it was busy. The following 4 miles cycling towards Hope weren't very pleasant, as there was a lot of traffic. 30 years ago, we had a night's B&B in Hope, at the house of a river warden who welcomed us with tea and scones. The village hadn't seemed nearly so big or so busy back then. According to my 1985 diary, we'd parted with £25 that day, which included accommodation and dinner at the pub.
After Hope, we pedalled on into the even busier village of Bamford, where we spent a frustrating half hour trying to find the cycleway leading to Lady Bower Reservoir. We didn't succeed, but eventually found our way to Lady Bower, where we pushed the bike over the dam at the lower part of the reservoir before joining a track leading around the water. We ate our picnic lunch on a seat overlooking the reservoir. Six young lads, probably aged about 15, and with enormous rucksacks, plonked themselves down nearby. One boy was vociferously wishing himself elsewhere, and the others were teasing him, when a group of girls similarly encumbered with backpacks approached. The lads fell silent while the girls passed, continuing to chat and casting not a glance in their direction. I recalled my own long-ago teenage days, when 15-year-old boys were little better than pond life to girls of a similar age. Everything changes, but everything stays the same. Yes, indeed. The track eventually petered out and joined the A57, which we cycled along before turning left up another leg of Lady Bower towards Fairholme's Visitor Centre. Unfortunately, we didn't have time to cycle around Derwent Reservoir, so had to content ourselves with turning right below the Derwent Water Dam to follow Lady Bower back to our starting point, where we managed to pick up the Thornhill Trail, which had eluded us earlier. Back at Bamford, we joined the A road leading towards Hope and continued into Bradwell, birthplace of Samuel Fox, inventor of the modern umbrella. We were soon off the bike and trudging up a relentlessly steep hill overlooking Hope Quarry. At the top, we settled down to tea and cake, sitting on a surprisingly comfortable old milk churn outside Paradise Farm and enjoying superb views over Edale Moor and Kinder Scout. Down into Tideswell, a busy village was endlessly celebrating Wakes Week amidst the multitude of attractively decorated homes and shops. Then it was a swoop down into Millersdale and the familiar slog back to Taddington.
And now Thursday the 25th of June, the plague village and bull baiting. We set off at 9:15 in warm sunshine and cycled to Overhaddon, an attractive village near Bakewell. Alan remembers coming here as a lad with the Barnsley Road Club back in the 1960s. After freewheeling down to Lathkill Dale, we locked the bike to some railings and walked along a footpath downstream to a place where it widened out into clear water beside a steep, tree-lined cliff. Here the river was so clear we were able to watch a dabchick swimming under the water. We went into Bakewell, where I seized the opportunity to revisit the prize-winning loos, while Alan bought more Bakewell tarts from another bakery. We took a road uphill past the golf course, through Hall Cross, and then into Pilsley, passing the entrance to Chatsworth Estate Farm Shop. After Baslow, we followed a narrow road signposted to Barnsley Farm, climbing a very long hill and pausing at the top to admire views over Chatsworth with a glimpse of its Empora Fountain, which reaches a height of 60 metres. We intended making Iam our lunch destination, but after Calva we were thwarted in our plans when confronted by a no-access sign on the minor road we'd planned to take. A local cyclist stopped to offer assistance and assured us that although there was some subsidence, the road wasn't entirely blocked. So we were treated to a pleasantly traffic-free ride, eating our picnic on a bench overlooking Iam and pondering on its macabre history. In August 1665, the village tailor received a parcel of damp cloth from London, which was harbouring plague fleas, and before the week was out, the tailor was dead. Within a short time, 28 villagers became victims of the plague. Terror was rife, but William Montpesson, the charismatic church leader, persuaded his flock not to flee, but to isolate themselves from the outside world. A year later, only 90 of the 350 villagers were left alive, and Montpesson's wife was one of those who perished. Iam's bravery probably saved thousands of lives in the north of England. After visiting the church, where some young lads were searching for graves of plague victims, we took a byway which proclaimed itself open to all traffic. This turned into a long uphill walk along a muddy and rocky track, which eventually brought us out onto a road which led to Breton and the highest pub in Derbyshire. We cycled along the top road for a while, enjoying terrific views, before descending into Great Hucklow, turning to Grindlow and then on into the picturesque village of Foolow, complete with duck pond, manor house, village cross and a gruesome slice of social history. Beside the cross is a bull ring embedded in a boulder, used in the 19th century to tether bulls before they were set upon by villagers' dogs, in the mistaken belief that this brutality tenderised the meat prior to slaughter. Crossing the A623, we took a practically traffic-free road across Longstone Moor to Longstone Edge, where we poured the final dregs of tea from our flask and sampled the Bakewell tarts, which turned out to be yet another culinary disappointment, alleviated by fantastic views over to Chatsworth. Late afternoon, we dropped down into Great Longstone and Little Longstone before finally reaching Monsell Head. We were aiming for the Monsell Trail,
but with no apparent route leading to it, we cycled into Ashford and asked for directions. Two well-meaning women did their best to help, but we ended up pedalling for miles along the A6020 before reaching Hassop Station, and at last we thankfully joined the Monsal Trail. Back to Taddington at 7:20 p.m. after our longest Derbyshire day yet.
Friday the 26th of June. A police presence in Overhaddon and a fearless curlew. Weather slightly drizzly and muggy. From Millersdale, we cycled a couple of miles to the start of the Monsal Trail at Wydale, just to satisfy ourselves we'd done all of it. Actually, this part is possibly the most dramatic, with another tunnel and steep limestone cliffs used for climbing and abseiling from a bridge. We passed a couple of young children preparing to abseil down. The rain was heavier now, so we stopped at Hassop Station for coffee and cake. There's a bookshop with a lot of cycling books, and I managed to secure an order for 6 copies of my book, Life in Tandem, Tales of Cycling Travels. Drooping down into Bakewell, we found yet another cake shop and bought a large Bakewell tart for the friend who was feeding our cat. It looks tasty, but then so had all the others. Cycled back to Over Haddon, and managed to locate a pretty cottage we'd seen for sale in an estate agent's window. We always play this game when we're on holiday, but I very much doubt if we'll ever move from Dorset. We ate our lunch on a seat in the churchyard and chatted to a local chap who was a cyclist and had done the heroic 100-mile route on Sunday. He showed us the grave of Maurice Oldfield, a British intelligence officer and espionage administrator. Major Oldfield was also head of MI6 in the 1970s, at which time there was a police officer on constant guard outside his home in Overhaddon. During these years, the village was apparently viewed as the safest place to live in all of Derbyshire. We took the road to Long Edge, stopping at a bridge over the river, where we saw a kingfisher and baby coots. Then, a not overly pleasant slog to Parsley Hay, along a road used by quarry lorries, uphill and against a strong headwind. After reaching the bustling village of Hartington, our afternoon took a turn for the better. We followed a very pretty gated road high above the Dove Valley, and with the River Dove as our constant companion. The sun came out, so we sat on a grassy bank to admire the view and drink our Earl Grey tea, apparently accompanied by all butter Earl Grey and lemon shortbread biscuits. Although rather disappointed to reach the end of this little track, on reaching the isolated hamlet of Pillsbury, we enjoyed pedalling down the quiet road towards Money Ash. A highlight of this last stretch was being treated to the sight of a curlew, sitting on a dry stone wall close to the road and completely unfazed by our approach. And there's a lovely photograph of it here, much bigger bird than I thought. Back at Taddington, we packed our suitcase before driving out to the Barrel Inn for a meal. We toasted our holiday over a glass of Rioja, promising not to risk leaving it another 30 years before we returned to Derbyshire, and next time we might even splash out on a new map. And Jackie Winter's book, Life in Tandem, Tales of Cycling Travels, is available from Amazon, on Kindle, and in paperback, or from Jackie on 01929 459207. And there's a little picture of the front cover of the book here as well.